Great, thanks very much. So can everyone hear me okay? All good, great. So thanks for inviting me here. It's really good to be back. It's been a little while, but it's nice to see some new faces as well. So I'm gonna talk about, as Kendrick said, something a bit different to what I normally work on, which is lots of random things in cosmology. This is a random thing in kind of galaxy population studies and evolution. But there's a very close link to cosmology, as I'll attempt to convince you. And the basic idea behind this entire talk is we need some way of connecting galaxies to the underlying distribution of matter in the universe. We want to understand and model very accurately that connection so that we can then go off and do interesting things in fundamental physics and cosmology. So I'll start off by just kind of trying to motivate this a bit. So, I mean, probably most of you are bored to death of hearing about new surveys just on the horizon. So I'll bore you some more, I'm afraid. So over the next 10 or so years, there's just going to be an absolute ton of new large-scale structure surveys of various stripes. And they're going to be massive. They're going to be returning tens of millions, hundreds of millions, some even billions of galaxies. Some of them will have very accurate redshifts, some of them won't. Some of them won't see individual galaxies at all. They'll just see kind of the average distribution of galaxies. These are these intensity mapping experiments. You have enhanced CMB surveys, things that can really get to the secondary anisotropies in the CMB, all sorts of things. And we're just gonna have this deluge of data. We're not used to dealing with all of this. And hidden within this data are what we hope will be some very interesting but very subtle signatures of various fundamental physical processes, that this might actually be our kind of last chance to try and tease out and observe, because we're eventually gonna hit this dreaded cosmic variance limit where we've effectively measured all of the available statistical modes of, say, the matter distribution in the universe, and it's not gonna be possible to pull out any more unique information. So I'm gonna try and convince you that there's a more optimistic way of looking at this doomsday scenario where we're all out of jobs. And the way to do that is by combining different surveys in a specific way. Okay, and of course there are more prosaic reasons for wanting to combine surveys. Again, maybe you've come across some of these, but especially, you know, a lot of these data sets, they're big, but they're also complicated. They're just full of various systematic effects that you really need to pull out so you're not mistaking them for physics. And so by combining surveys in a smart way, you can actually cancel out a lot of systematic effects and be much more confident that you're actually measuring a physical signal instead of some properties of dust in the galaxy or things like that. So here's some pictures of some of the instruments that are going to do these surveys. I won't spend too long on this, but the main point here is, you've probably heard of most of these, but the main point here is we're actually going to be covering a really wide redshift range, so much wider than we've ever accessed before in terms of these direct measurements of the clustering of matter on reasonably large scales. So there are new surveys that are going to cover a redshift range from 0 to 6. Beyond that, we're talking about epoch of reionization experiments, which are already underway, and you know they're not really strictly going for the cosmic density field. They're going for a combination of that and an ionization field. But anyway, I mean, we're really taking a huge snapshot of the universe over a massive range of redshifts now, and that's a huge amount of data and a huge amount of statistical power that we can apply to cosmological problems. The problem is we don't just get this from one nice homogeneous survey that we know everything about. We get this from this kind of almost random collection of very, very different techniques. Some of them are ground-based, like LSST. Some of them are space-based, like Euclid or WFIRST. Some of them are in the optical and near-infrared. Some of them are in the radio, like the square kilometer array. All of these are very, very different beasts, and combining them is a big job. So here are some ways that you can combine different surveys to hopefully learn something extra than what you get from the individual surveys. So the classic one is just independently combining them. So if the surveys are covering independent volumes of the universe, It's fine to just pull some parameter constraints out of each survey and then kind of combine them in a kind of inverse covariance weighted sense and just, you know, produce some improved parameter constraints. You know, you use survey A, combine it with survey B, and maybe you break some degeneracies on certain parameters and measure the parameters you're interested in more accurately. And that's kind of where we are right now. A lot of the work is focusing on this kind of thing, mostly because we don't have many overlapping surveys. So they exist, but we don't have so many of them. Something kind of at a similar level of sophistication is what I'll call template subtraction. So you have some survey A, and that survey happens to just be really good at telling you where the dust in the galaxy is or some other contaminating effect. So you use that information about something maybe non-cosmological to clean this horrible systematic effect from some other survey, survey B, and then in doing that cleaning, you can more accurately reconstruct the signal in the second survey, and voila, you've actually measured the thing you were trying to measure. So that's very important at the moment as well. Going forward, as things start overlapping a lot more, we're kind of moving to a phase where cross-correlations are really a very necessary thing that everyone is seeking to do because it really does give you extra information. It enhances the amount of information that you have. So you can imagine if you just had two surveys and you just had the auto power spectra or something, you're missing this off-diagonal component, which is their cross spectra. There's more information there, like more physical information. So now people are trying to do the best to, especially with the CMB and large-scale structure traces, that they're trying to get these cross correlations out as well. And then what I would say was the ultimate level of sophistication is doing a full joint analysis, where you don't just do the auto spectra, or you don't just do the cross spectra. You do all of them together in one big, block matrix and pull all of the information out consistently and coherently and simultaneously. And this is something that's seen as reasonably ambitious, so people are certainly trying it. But in order to do that, you don't just multiply the two things and then get the auto spectra as well. You have all these low-level systematic effects that you want to worry about. And you want to make sure that you're treating them in a consistent way, because otherwise you're combining two things that might be inconsistent, or you might end up just, correlating common systematic effects between the two things and not really measuring what you want to measure. Because once you do this, your error bars get smaller and you can't hide behind big error bars anymore. You really need to find all of this, kind of crap at low levels that needs to be cleaned out. So I'm going to kind of pull away from this kind of talking about systematic effects and things like that and start talking a bit more about the cosmology that we can get out of things like this sophisticated joint analysis that I've been talking about. And a really important application of this in my mind is this question of evading cosmic variance. So cosmic variance is this fundamental limit to measurement precision in cosmology when you're looking at stochastic quantities. So, and again, as probably all, if not most, if not all of you are aware, cosmic variance is a fundamental limit if all you're interested in is the statistics of two-point functions or endpoint functions, say, because what you're trying to do is reconstruct the actual ensemble value of the variance of some field. So let's say the cosmic matter distribution or something like that. You want to know its power spectrum. And the thing that's actually connected to your theoretical models is the ensemble variance. That's the thing you can calculate. But we only have access to a finite number of Fourier modes for which we can measure this power spectrum. And so you can never quite be sure if you're measuring this particular ensemble power spectrum or something that's like some small error bar away from that because of this cosmic variance effect, because you haven't measured all of the possible modes in the entire universe, because we can't access them, because we are not causally connected to them. So we see a finite number of Fourier modes. There's no real way around that. We can't get more Fourier modes, really. We can try and measure things down to smaller scales. We can do a better job of probing inside our own cosmic horizon, but as I mentioned at the start, we're kind of slowly approaching the state where, you know, there's going to be a phase of diminishing returns, and then eventually maybe we've measured them all, and that's all of the information. Except it's not all of the information, because we don't just care about two-point functions or endpoint functions, right? There are things that you can measure that are cosmologically interesting that aren't inherently statistical quantities, okay? There are things that you can measure that are deterministic. We think it's just a property of the universe that wasn't set kind of stochastically at some initial point. You know, it's really, you know, some functional property that you can measure, and you're not doing statistics, essentially. The statistics only come in combining measurements which have error bars. Okay, so I've said all of that, but let's talk about, for example, the dark matter field, for example. So if you just have one tracer of the dark matter field, you're measuring something that's you know, has some additional clustering with respect to the underlying dark matter distribution, but under it all, that dark matter distribution has a stochastic initial condition, so it's a random field. Okay, so the things you're measuring are random. So let's try and, you know, look at this in a bit more of a mathematical way. So if you have some tracer, let's just call it some tracer one or something. The way it traces the underlying dark matter distribution on linear scales, say in a simple, this is just the Kaiser picture of, you know, you have some bias tracer with some redshift space distortions. So this is what you see. You see, because this is stochastic, this will also be stochastic. And so if you take any two-point function involving this, it's also going to be stochastic, okay? But imagine if, and I'm not saying you actually do this in real life, but just as a simple example, imagine if you take the ratio of these two tracers, that notice they have a different bias with respect to the underlying dark matter distribution. And you find this, and you look at this, and under some reasonable approximations, you find that this ratio is actually deterministic. So if you could actually measure things like ratios of two different tracers, even though those tracers are themselves stochastic, you're kind of, in some sense, canceling out the stochastic parts. The stochastic parts are the same. This is the same realization of the dark matter distribution as this. And so by canceling them out, you're just left with a deterministic piece, which in principle you can measure with infinite precision, as long as you can keep beating down the dominant source of noise, which for a galaxy survey, for example, would be shot noise. You can just keep shrinking those error bars and shrinking those error bars. So that's great. I mean, we've measured a quantity and we've potentially evaded cosmic variance, but this is a quantity that depends on astrophysics, right? Or you know, some quantity that depends on the way that the galaxy is formed. So is that so interesting to cosmologists? Well, I'd argue yes, because you also pull in a kind of true cosmological function in here as well, which is that this F is the linear growth rate. And if you're interested in doing things like testing general relativity on very large scales, this is fantastically interesting, right? This is exactly one of the quantities that you want to measure as accurately as possible. So you can see that we can beat cosmic variance for certain quantities as long as we can keep improving our measurement precision, but only if we also have some way of modeling this astrophysics-y stuff here. So there's no fundamental limit on how well we can measure this astrophysics-y stuff. It's just hard. Yeah.
I mean, I guess, though, there's an assumption in here, which is that the underlying theory or galaxy formation is going to be a deterministic and not a statistical. I mean, it sort of depends on what you're getting at, right? I mean,
yeah.
You can measure the actual realization of where stuff is in the universe with extremely high precision, but the reason that we don't necessarily directly apply that is because we have some statistical theory, and we really want to constrain the parameters of that statistical theory. So it's true, you can measure, you know, maybe bias parameters with infinite precision, but is that really useful unless the theory of, you know, the theory of galaxy biasing is itself a deterministic theory?
So the thing that matters for this exercise, so I agree with you, right? These things are very uncertain. They certainly have stochastic initial conditions of their own, but the question is whether that stochasticity enters here. Okay, and so it actually does on small scales. We think that the galaxy bias should be stochastic on small scales. So, you know, down there, if you want to go to really high K, this is certainly an issue, and that the uncertainty or the extra stochasticity due to these being stochastic will be important on those small scales and will ruin this eventually on small scales. But on large scales, we think there is quite a simple linear picture for the most part. Of how these things are related to the underlying dark matter distribution. They did cluster around the very large-scale dark matter distribution in a deterministic or an effectively deterministic way. That's what we think. But yeah, remember as well, I'm kind of saying, well, in principle, we could measure this with infinite precision. We can't, of course, because there's only a finite number of dark matter halos with galaxies in them or something. In the universe, there's a finite number of galaxies, so the shot noise has a flaw as well. The important thing is that this flaw seems to be significantly below the usual cosmic variance flaw for these two-point functions I'm interested in. So it's a good point, but it's some way further down than the regular cosmic variance issue. Does that answer your question? Okay. So let's carry on. So what are some applications? So once we've done away with this troublesome cosmic variance effect by selecting our observables carefully and doing this careful joint analysis, what physics can we actually access with this sort of thing? So something that's very interesting to me is trying to figure out what's going on physically at the Hubble scale, because, you know, as you all know, this is a scale that, you know, enters all of cosmology in some way or another. And it would be especially good to know, given that we have all of these pretty clear signatures of new physics that are coming in at around the Hubble time, at around the Hubble scale, it would be nice to do some precision measurements, if possible, there to try and figure out if something's different, if something is different from the let's call it the standard cosmological model. Right, so maybe we can learn something about if it's dark energy and not a cosmological constant, what the nature of that dark energy is on large scales, or if it's not, if there's a modification to general relativity, and that's causing cosmic acceleration. Well, you need to add a new scale into your gravitational theory. It's reasonable to expect that new scale to be associated with the scale of the new physics, which is the Hubble scale. Anyway, so let's go and look at the Hubble scale and see if we can see if anything's amiss. The problem is the Hubble scale is an exceedingly large scale to us as observers. So you can just about see, when I say the Hubble scale, I mean Fourier wave number K is of order conformal H. Okay, and so that scale actually is only visible within our horizon around redshift 2 to 3. Okay, so if you go looking for that scale, you see it's going to be on extremely large scales. You're going to have to go to reasonably high redshift, and it's only going to have quite small effects on your observables because they tend to be more highly weighted towards the smaller scales. So there are some situations where you can access it. So this is a paper by Tessa Baker and I from a few years ago, and we kind of tried to work out, if you did just genuinely only have a deviation from general relativity at very large scales, so some number lambda times the Hubble scale, so these modifications come in at the Hubble scale for lambda equals to 1, they come in at 10 times smaller than the Hubble scale for lambda equal to 10, what would you see? Could you see anything, or are these things effectively unmeasurable? And this is what we found. So it's reasonably well known that you can see very small effects in the CMB if there's some stuff going on, around the Hubble scale. We were finding deviations for a few different ansatz as for what this deviation would look like. We're finding a few percent level fractional difference in the CMB CLs, and that's kind of too small to measure. So at very low L, the cosmic variance error bar is, tens of percent typically. So maybe you get a hint of this, but you can't definitively say you've measured some new physics and not just measured, you know, a statistical fluke, essentially. Yep.
Cosmic acceleration comes in later.
Yep, but, so...
its effect on angular power spectrums. CFBs, how do you distinguish that from
Well, so what's actually going on here when I say the CMB, I don't mean the primary CMB. I actually mean the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect that is a late time effect. It's due to the integral through decaying potentials of, you know, the photon propagation. And, you know, this is the main thing you're responding to here. So this is a fractional deviation from GR. You see it's only a small effect, but this is essentially due to the fact that the growth rate would be slightly different. At late times, and so it's just modifying that integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect slightly, which is a small effect anyway, and it's only really significant at very low L.
GR is just a fixed background, if I tell you.
We are just assuming a perturbed free.
That's
what we're assuming for this work, yeah.
So you're looking for deviations from the fixed background.
I mean, in this particular plot, yes, we fixed the background to something that just has a standard cosmological constant equation of state. So, of course, you can have deviations from that very easily in some of these modified gravity theories. We didn't look into that, though, because a lot of these modified gravity theories have a relatively smooth limit to a lambda CDM-like background, leaving only modifications in the perturbative sector. I mean, there's no saying that's what we'd find. You know, maybe we'd find both together, but we were just focusing on this one case of, well, the background looks like lambda CDM. Can you see anything in the perturbation? So, you know, there's a lot of assumptions and special cases folded into this. It's just an illustration. But, you know, you see it's, the main point here is, you're not seeing much at these, you know, for a Hubble scale modification at late times, you're not seeing much at reasonably high L. I mean, no one would call L of 50 high L normally, but, you know, you only see stuff at this lower where cosmic variance is going to kill you. You can do the same exercise for the for galaxy clustering. So just look at, again, the angular power spectrum of galaxy clustering. One or two different traces, for example. And again, you see that these effects are mostly limited to these very low L. And these are even smaller. You know, they're at the maybe 0.1% level. So this is impossible to measure due to cosmic variance, unless you could do some really extremely accurate multi-tracer type analysis where, you know, you're exceeding the cosmic variance bound by, you know, two or three orders of magnitude. I'm not sure that in itself is physically possible, but, you know, to start ruling out these Hubble scale effects, if everything on smaller scales looks standard, that's what we've got to do, right? That's the only option after a point. There's no kind of magical new observable that can get us around this. I think this is the only way to really know for certain, you know, whether these very large scales are consistent with our standard model or not. You know, this is kind of the end game, if you will. So that one's not quite as optimistic, but I think this one is maybe a bit more practical. So we can talk about Mach correlation functions. So in a lot of these non-GR theories, you end up either naturally getting some kind of screening effect or having to introduce one by hand to satisfy constraints on gravitation on very small scales, so in the solar system or around binary pulsars. And those are very stringent constraints, so you need some way of getting your new gravitational theory to effectively reduce to something that looks like GR on small scales. But you want it to be interesting as well. So you maybe want some new phenomenology on large scales. So you need this transition behavior where you're transitioning from a GR behavior on small scales to something that isn't necessarily GR on large scales. So the mechanism that allows you to do this, they're all bundled under the the category of screening mechanisms. And quite a generic effect of these screening mechanisms is to introduce an environment-dependent clustering signal. So the screening tends to kick in areas of, say, higher matter density. And so in those areas, the strength of gravity effectively is slightly different to in lower density regions. And so you have differences in the clustering just due to effectively the environment of the things that are clustering. So you can measure this, or you can try and measure this, but it's actually going to be pretty hard because there are other environment-dependent effects just in regular galaxy evolution, for example. So you need some really kind of sensible model of, you know, how galaxies should cluster in different environments, both with and without these environment-dependent gravitational effects. So I think that's an unsolved problem at the minute. No one has such a model. But if you can get around that, you can measure these environment-dependent clustering effects, and they give you actually quite unique signatures of certain modified gravity theories, or at least theories with different screening mechanisms. Here's just a quick example. The kind of clustering observable I'm showing here is the velocity dispersion correlation function. Velocities happen to be quite sensitive to modifications to gravity for somewhat obvious reasons. I'm showing those against the density of the local environment as measured by some tracer. So log 10 of the density contrast plus 1 along here, and then effectively the deviation from GR of this clustering observable here. And you see, you know, you have these different shapes. It doesn't matter what these models are, but, you know, you can get different shapes as a function of the local density, depending on the theory you're looking at. Okay, so, and you know, I just thought I'd briefly mention this as well, because this is a bit more well known. You know, to measure primordial non-Gaussianity with sufficient precision to test a lot of, you know, more standard inflationary models, you need to get below approximately a sigma FNL error on the FNL of about 1. You can't do that, it seems, purely with CMB, and even purely with CMB plus a large-scale structure survey. You can maybe get to around sigma FNL of 1. It's very, very hard to get below it because of this cosmic variance issue. And so what we found in this paper and this follow-up paper by David Alonso and Pedro Ferreira was that, you know, when we kind of put our best foot forward and make some very idealized and very optimistic forecasts, even then the only way you're going to get sigma FNL below 1 is by doing a multi-tracer type analysis. Okay. So in all of these cases, we're making some use. Yep, go ahead.
Give me an example of more than one tracer.
More than one tracer. So one example would be, say, a survey that exclusively detects star-forming galaxies, and another one might be a survey that exclusively detects passive galaxies, so elliptical galaxies.
Why would you a priori think that they have any different distribution?
So they cluster differently is the reason, and that the typical explanation for that is that they tend to form in different masses of dark matter halos. So larger dark matter halos can support the formation of very large elliptical type galaxies, for example, that might have formed through merging processes and stuff like that. And, you know, so you get the picture. Okay. But yeah, the point is different types of galaxies, say, or this applies to other tracers as well. Think about intensity mapping with different spectral lines or something like that. They will cluster differently on average. Okay. So in all of the cases I just mentioned, we need to know this relative clustering very accurately. Otherwise, what we're really measuring is the relative clustering rather than the cosmological signal we're interested in. So in order to do that, very, very crucially, we need to understand this connection between galaxies and, for example, the underlying dark matter distribution, right? The thing that we're predicting in, say, a standard cosmological model is the statistics of the underlying dark matter distribution. And these galaxies are kind of things almost floating on top of that. So we need to know the connection between the two. Otherwise, we're measuring one thing, we're theoretically interested in another thing, and we have no way to get between them in a sensible way. So how do we do this? Well, we need a model of galaxies and how they populate the universe. And they're really complicated. So I'll just give you a few brief examples of some of the approaches people are taking with this. The kind of simplest, but probably most successful so far in large-scale structure studies is these halo models, where you assume that the underlying dark matter distribution is bundled up into collapsed halos, and halos of different masses support different types of galaxies, as we just discussed. And all that you care about is having some fitting relation between, the mass of a dark matter halo and the properties of the galaxy. Very simple properties of the galaxy. So I just mean its luminosity or the number of galaxies that would live in a large halo, or just essentially one number that describes that population of galaxies. This is great because it's a very simple analytic model that you end up building. It's really quick to calculate. You can marginalize over uncertainty in this model. Maybe it has a few parameters. You can throw those parameters into your cosmological analysis as well. But again, it's only really predicting a few properties, and it's actually tied to the way you calibrate these things, right? You're not really developing a model of the galaxies. You're just saying, well, this set of galaxies, this population of galaxies, has some common properties that I can describe as, by kind of shuffling them into a certain mass range of dark matter halos. So it's very simple, it's very powerful as a result of its simplicity, but it has limits. Another option, which is kind of going even further, is these empirical models. So you essentially just reproduce observables by construction. So you just have some training data sets. So hopefully quite a deep one. For example, there are very small surveys done by the Hubble Space Telescope. You get a big population of galaxies that in a lot of detail what those galaxies look like. And then you kind of try and extrapolate from that population what all of the other galaxies in the universe might look like. Essentially just using simple fitting functions and similar techniques. People have been trying to do more sophisticated things using machine learning, for example, but it's still effectively an extrapolation from a small training set. And so this is good because it at least reproduces the observables in your training set by construction. And again, it can be fast and it can actually be very detailed depending on the level of sophistication you're willing to go to. But it's super, super reliant on the quality of the training data and exactly how well you've measured the properties of these galaxies. And if the big survey you're applying this to looks different to your training data, it's not clear that you will get anything sensible out of this. There are ways of trying to mitigate like selection effects and things like that, but they're in there. And the other thing is it's not really predictive. It's only predictive in the sense that an extrapolation is predictive. Okay, you're making some assumption about what the functions you're extrapolating look like. This is just a small picture of, this is a simulated dark matter distribution in the faint blue in the background. And people can look for these clumps of collapsed dark matter in that dark matter halos and then assign galaxy properties to those. So more sophisticated physics-based methods are these semi-analytic models. These are things which kind of try and strike a balance between modeling the full physics of galaxies, which would be extremely complicated, and just modeling just enough physics. So you don't want to do a full radiative transfer problem, for example, but you want to put in some functions that give you a kind of average sense of what that radiative transfer problem would look like. So you're trying to cobble together some acceptable semi-analytic model of how galaxies form. And then you're evolving that forward and letting these galaxies form under these simplified physical assumptions. So there's physics in there. You have to spend a lot of effort figuring out how to model the physics in a clever way, so you can actually solve the problem and and you know, so it's fast enough. But the upside is you get very detailed results out. That said, they're still very expensive. So even with all these simplifications, you're still modeling a lot of things. And so the current state of the art is roughly for, you know, a relatively you know, sophisticated semi-analytic model, but with some of the accuracy settings turned down, it takes maybe 1 second to model one galaxy. So if you have a survey of a billion galaxies, that's a bit of a that's a pain, right? That's pretty heavy. I mean, you can do it. We have computers big enough to do that sort of thing with no real problems. But these things also depend on a number of input parameters that are kind of parameterizing our ignorance of, say, radiative transfer processes or something like that. You have to tune those to actually fit some, you know, observed data, your reference data. And every time you change one of those parameters, you have to rerun the whole thing over some set of, I don't know, dark matter halos that you've simulated or something. And so, again, remember, it's about 1 second per galaxy. So just, you know, changing that parameter once gives you a long wait before you can draw your next sample in an MCMC chain or something like that. So they're detailed. They have a lot of good properties in the sense of being more physically realistic, but they're still very heavy computationally. People have done Monte Carlo type studies with this, but I think, you know, they will never do them again because they went through a lot of pain just to get 800 samples, I think. So it's still very heavy stuff. And then, you know, the kind of ultimate in physics-based modeling is hydrodynamical simulations. So this is somewhere where you do really want to examine all of the physics, have all of the relevant fields, dark matter distribution, you know, the UV photon flux, everything. You know, you want to evolve all of that together and connect it through known physics and try and solve all of those equations and, you know, get the most accurate picture out that you possibly can. That's, needless to say, very computationally complex. These things tend to be restricted to very small simulation boxes. So people are doing, you know, tens of megaparsecs on the side simulations. One of the reasons for that is the huge dynamic range you need to do these simulations. So, you know, we think that there are processes on relatively large scales of order, you know, the size of, you know, the separation of typical separation of galaxies. We think there are processes there that are affected by the energy that's injected by, say, individual supernovae or the details of an individual active galactic nucleus and the way that's dumping energy into the intergalactic medium. So to really do a rigorous job of this, you need to be simulating, I don't know, the accretion disk of an AGN at the same time as, you know, a whole cluster of galaxies. That's a huge dynamic range with many different physical processes going on. And that's very difficult. People are making great headway on that using these kind of multi-scale or zooming simulations. So here's an example of you know, some very sophisticated stuff from the FIRE project, you know, where they're really following the evolution of, you know, all of the gas dynamics over a very long period of time. But, you know, again, they still, to get anywhere, still need to rely on adding a few parameters in a subgrid sense, as they call it, where you know, you're again simplifying some physical processes, and, you know, building an effective model with parameters that you need to tune. And like I said, this is even more computationally complex. You can use these to inform some of these other galaxy models, for example, but simulating the entire volume of LSST or something using one of these, you know, LSST would be fully mothballed before that simulation even finished. So I you know, it's not necessarily very possible. So I will move on and tell you what I think would be what I hope would be a reasonable solution to having an accurate enough model of the relative clustering in these multi-tracer scenarios without having to do these huge simulations necessarily. But, you know, moving beyond the simplicity of these halo models and empirical models. So it's a compromise solution that sits somewhere between. So just to illustrate the problem, imagine I want to predict what would happen if I cross-correlated the some sample of galaxies from LSST with some sample of, which is an optical experiment, with some sample of galaxies from the Square Kilometer Array, which is a radio experiment. So these empirical approaches, I mean, you need multi-wavelength data to calibrate them, but that doesn't exist yet. So I can't exactly make predictions. I'd just be making it all up. In the HALO model, it's a bit more promising, but it's difficult to ensure consistency because, again, you are relying on an empirical calibration. You're building a model, but then you're fitting to it. You're fitting it to, you kind of already need that radio cross optical information to properly calibrate that model. And then again, with these things, the semi-analytic models and the hydrodynamical simulations, you can get these actually quite consistent predictions of what, say, the radio and optical galaxies will look like. But again, you want to change parameters and stuff to make sure you're fitting the data properly, and you can't do it because they're too expensive. So what do I want to do? I'm essentially going to take the HALO model approach, which, remember, it's relatively simple. But people have been using it for large-scale structure stuff already, and it's fast enough to do Monte Carlo type studies and things like that, but it's lacking in detail. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that approach and add some detail in a very specific way by adding a statistical model on top of it. It's going to be based on modeling this connection between galaxies and dark matter halos. It's just going to use simple analytic expressions. They turn out to be enough. I don't have to solve any differential equations, for example, which would bump it into this category of a semi-analytic model. So it's fast and it's cheap. I can do statistical analyses with it. But I'm going to actually layer on a number of physical properties of the galaxies as kind of intermediate steps, which is going to let me build actually quite a detailed model of the properties of these galaxies. So again, not as detailed as a semi-analytic model or a hydrodynamical simulation, but I would argue enough detail to actually make this work. So the approach is this: given some properties of a dark matter halo, that as in the HALO model approach, you just start off with a dark matter halo of some mass. I'm going to predict some certain, certain bulk properties of the galaxies that might live in that halo. So by bulk properties, I just mean, it's total stellar mass, the total mass of stars in that galaxy, or it's current star formation rate. Very broad brushstrokes, physical properties of the galaxies. And then once I have those, I'm going to connect those quantities to direct observables or almost direct observables. So things like luminosities in some emission line or an optical magnitude or something that an observer can measure without too much model interpretation, just using an image or something like that.
So in this approach, what does that mean for these multi-scale things that happen at smaller scale that affect the larger scale and the impact? What does this model saying about these processes?
So I'll kind of touch on that a bit later, but what I'm saying is I'm not interested in the individual galaxy. As you are, so the semi-analytic approach and the hydrodynamical approach, what you're trying to do is build up the properties of a population of galaxies by doing a really good job of modeling the properties of individual galaxies and then just generating a load of galaxies, right? So you're trying to get the statistics by getting all of the individual galaxies right. Here I'm kind of turning that on its head. All I care about for this particular multi-tracer problem is knowing the statistical properties of the population of galaxies. So for an individual galaxy, I'm not worrying about any of those processes. I just kind of worry about what the the coarse-grained properties of the galaxy population are. And so those processes on small scales will affect that coarse-grained distribution. I'm saying I don't care how that coarse-grained distribution got there particularly, just that I can model it somehow in a sensible way.
So you assume they got to some equilibrium and just finding the statistical properties of this different equilibria that you would approach or something?
It doesn't even have to be an equilibrium. You can just think about it as, you know, doing a good job of modeling moments of the statistical distribution of these galaxy properties.
Because each galaxy has a mass density profile, two or three parameters for each galaxy. Mm-hmm. Mass to light ratio. So the number of parameters must increase very rapidly if you start individual issues.
So it can do if you need to model those, but what I'll show here is for the quantities I'm interested in right now, and certainly you might be interested in those properties and you'd want to do more than this, but properties I'm interested in right now, it's sufficient to just get away with these, you know, simple few parameters per galaxy and treat those in a statistical way.
How many parameters do you end up with?
So in the full model that I'm going to present very shortly, it ends up being 17 for the full model.
17?
Yeah. Not per galaxy. The entire set of galaxy distributions that encompasses optical and radio populations.
So a lot of parameters.
Galaxies are complicated. It's, you know, you can't...
If 17 parameters fit a lot of physics.
Mm-hmm. I'll show you what the fits look like. Because those parameters aren't just, you know, made up Taylor expansions, like, or something as you might do in the empirical approach. They're physics based. This will become clearer when I show you. So what I'm really doing, I want to model this. I want to model the joint distribution of all these galaxy and dark matter halo properties. So I'm going to assume these galaxies live in some dark matter halo of some mass. Each galaxy is going to have a total stellar mass. It's going to have some instantaneous star formation rate. It's going to have some luminosity and different emission lines, things like that. But what I want to model is just this joint distribution, because then I can fit any population of galaxies into this joint distribution, right? It will live somewhere in that parameter space. Because, you know, all galaxies have these properties, so it has to live somewhere in that parameter space. The question is, how do you model that joint distribution? And so as we just discussed, these semi-analytic models and the hydrodynamical simulations aren't modeling that distribution directly. They are generating lots and lots of different galaxies using as much physics as they can, and they're effectively reconstructing that joint distribution just by Monte Carloing lots of galaxies. But even then, they don't necessarily measure that joint distribution and, you know, come up with a representation of it. They just come up with a catalog of galaxies and say, that's what we think this population of galaxies should look like. I want to model this directly. I want an expression for this thing that I can evaluate. And I'm saying I want to evaluate it analytically as well. So we can get a bit of help with this. So even though the joint distribution is going to be horrendously complex, you know, people are spending many millions of computer hours effectively regenerating this joint distribution time and time again. I'm going to say, well, we can make some kind of simplifications to this structure by decomposing the joint distribution into a chain of conditional distributions. And my hope is that each of those conditional distributions is tractable. So, you know, something I can write down a sensible model for. Without having to oversimplify things too much. But then when I chain them together in this way, I can actually reconstruct this full joint distribution that might actually be quite complicated. So that's what I'm doing. Just to give you an example, you know, can we decompose this big joint distribution into conditional distributions? There are actually a number of very well-established relations. I say well-established, I mean empirically well-established, and or through these more detailed physics-based simulations, that there are these conditional distributions that they're actually reasonably tight relations with reasonably well-measured scatter. So here's an example of the stellar mass versus halo mass distribution. So given what you think the mass of the dark matter halo is, what do you think the stellar mass? What is the stellar mass of a galaxy in that halo? And these are all measurements. Okay, I think they're all at the same redshift here. So this is halo mass along the bottom. This is stellar mass over halo mass at the top. And you see, they're actually following a pretty, you know, smooth-looking curve.
Why what sense are they measurements? Halo of mass is always modeled.
So it's when I don't mean directly measured, I mean it's a derived quantity from measurements, but they have gone out to real galaxies and tried to establish the halo mass and reproduce this distribution. I don't mean it's it's not simulated.
The halo mass is the top measure.
Yeah. And there are various methods for doing this. So one might be weak lensing, although that's still relatively difficult to do. I think a lot of these probably rely on dynamical estimates of the halo mass. And again, there are systematics in there. And you know, you don't have to fully trust the exact halo mass measurements these people are getting, but I doubt they're wrong by factors of 10 or more. Right? The fact that everyone's getting this kind of comparable form of this relation is reasonably compelling. Again, you can argue, but the general form is there, and that's all I need to care about. I don't care about what they measure for the specific shape of this. You know, look, this pink line differs quite a lot from this blue line, for example. For this particular exercise, I don't care. I just need a functional form for this conditional distribution that's simple enough for me to parameterize it. And then those are some parameters of my model that I can then fit using more direct observations.
You don't care about problem galaxy, well-known low surface brightness galaxies, all that stuff?
No, not at the moment, no. Well, not for this particular... I wouldn't say it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters in some sense. Not for this, no. You can imagine putting them into this model. I'll show you the full model in a second, and it might make it a bit clearer. But I'm not doing that right now. This is a kind of proof of concept thing. So it seems reasonable that at least for this conditional distribution, you can come up with a simple model that looks a bit like a double power law that has some scatter around it. Again, the scatter would, is probably satisfactorily simply modeled by just a single scatter parameter, or maybe something with a slight dependence on halo mass or something. But again, you can come up with a simple analytical model for this conditional distribution for a large population of galaxies. Another example is the star-forming main sequence. So here I've got stellar mass. Here I've got star formation rate. Again, you're measuring the stellar mass or the star formation rate, not directly, but through interpreting some other observables. So, there are error bars on these points, really. But again, I don't need to worry about that too much, as long as I can write down a simple enough conditional distribution. So given some stellar mass, can I have some model for what the star formation rate should be in a statistical sense? And again, you can. A power law seems to be sufficient, at least from the current measurements people are making. Again, with some scatter, log normal scatter, these are all log axes after all. And that scatter can be quite large, and you can hide a multitude of sins within a large scatter, of course. But at least, I can come up with a model that's simple enough. Yeah.
What would you argue the physics is behind that relationship, excuse me, as opposed to star formation rate as a function of gas mass?
In this whole game I'm playing, there are these. So you're talking about what, the Kennicott relation or?
Well, I expect star formation to depend on gas density.
So.
If there are already stars, it's over and done with. There's no gas, there aren't going to be anymore.
Well, where does that gas come from, right? And so a lot of that gas is being enriched by previous phases of star formation. Those previous phases of star formation are described in a coarse grain way by the stellar mass, right? I'm not saying this is a direct one-to-one physical correspondence. I'm just saying that there is a correlation due to these physical processes that are going on. And, this is observed, right? Again, I mean, you see this in simulations too, but these are observations. People who are more familiar with actual galaxy evolution will be able to give you a much more sensible answer for what the actual physics is. But there's clearly some correlation, there's clearly some connection.
I'm just going to take it at face value.
Yeah, for now. you could then go back and, you know, I'm going to write down this simple model here where, you know, the actual parameters of that model, I'm not caring about where they come from too much, but someone who does care about where they come from could link those parameters to things like variations in the gas mass. Okay, so we've seen that there's a few conditional distributions. How much time do I have left?
Nominally 2 minutes.
Okay, let's try out.
It's okay to go a few minutes
over. Okay, I will try not to be too late. So I'll just cut to the chase. This is the statistical model that I've been talking about for an hour, apparently. So very simple idea. You have this big joint distribution that you know should exist, right? You know that you can measure these properties of galaxies or their host halos or, you know, these observables, and you know that they will have some statistical connection to one another. A valid statistical connection would be that they're completely uncorrelated, but we know they're not due to various physical processes that we, as we discussed earlier, are hard to model. So I want to rebuild that joint distribution, and that's too hard to do directly. We break it into conditional distributions, which I've just shown exist, at least in some cases. And then to further simplify things, we might need to ignore some correlations in this big chain of conditional distributions just to build a model. So here's what I end up with just in this simple proof of concept. So I start with some distribution of dark matter halos as a function of mass and redshift. Then given that mass and redshift, I can predict the stellar mass using the relation I showed you. I can then predict other things like the star formation rates, given the stellar mass. I can predict this T stands for type of galaxy. This is a very unsophisticated model where I'm just saying, well, there's two types of galaxy. There's spirals and ellipticals, or more correctly, active galaxies, and so actively star-forming galaxies and passive galaxies. There's actually a lot more to it than that, but you know, you can imagine putting a couple more blobs in this diagram to account for that complexity. But again, proof of concept, just that simple division. And then once I have the star formation rate and the stellar mass, I can go on and actually just skip straight to observables. So a lot of observables, like for example the H-alpha luminosity, are very good proxies just for star formation rate. And in fact, people use them to measure star formation rate. So, you know, it's quite simple to predict that. There are more complicated things as well, like the infrared luminosity also seems to be a good tracer of star formation rate. But also, you can actually predict optical magnitudes in broadband filters using these two things. I'm going to show you that quickly, but I know I'm running out of time. The point being, you can go from dark matter halo mass, essentially, through a few physical properties, and then actually, people are using all these relations already, you know, connect those straight to observables. And this already is enough to do this optical galaxy, radio galaxy connection I was talking about. I think very briefly I'll show you the optical magnitude thing, just because that's the most mysterious thing that I had to kind of come up with some ansatz. It's kind of a dumb ansatz, but I'm saying that you can actually build, I mean, optical magnitudes are very complicated. You have all these different structures in magnitude and color space. So by color, I mean the difference between magnitudes and different bands. I'm not reproducing the full complexity of that space, but I can get I can do a reasonably good job of the magnitudes in each band. And the way I can do that is using, again, just effectively just postulating how the stellar mass and the star formation rate and, you know, a few extra scaling parameters could potentially predict the mean magnitude in a given band, and then just fitting these parameters. Okay, if you're interested in that, I'm sorry I'm rushing over it a bit, but please come and chat to me, because it's remarkable that it even works as well as it does. This is just to show you, I've taken the output of some semi-analytic simulations, reasonably sophisticated ones from a few years back, from Guo et al, that were painted on top of the Millennium simulation. This delta M is the difference in magnitude between the predicted mean magnitude from my model for those galaxies. And the actual magnitude it has in those much more, you know, physically complex semi-analytic simulations. And you can see a typical deviation is, you know, roughly 0.2 magnitudes from the mean. And again, on top of that, I'm modeling the scatter as well, because it's a statistical distribution. So, you know, this relation I showed you just now is, it's capturing something. It's not perfect. You know, you see these spots here and there that are quite seriously discrepant, but it's capturing a lot of stuff on average. You could do better, but again, this is a proof of concept. So I don't really want to hit 5 minutes late, so I'm just going to kind of quickly go through this last one or two points. So once you have this big chain of conditional distributions, each of those conditionals has a few parameters based on how you've parameterized these scaling relations, like the ones I showed you. Then you can go and calculate things through this chain of conditional distributions by marginalizing over the parameters you don't care about to get things like a luminosity function. And luminosity functions are more or less observables, and then you can go and fit to those observables and try and determine your parameters. So what I've done here is just taken, just at redshift zero for now, a couple of optical luminosity functions in the G and Z band, a radio luminosity function, and that's all, okay? I'm not using a halo mass stellar mass, relation, no, not an observed one. I'm not using some observations of the star forming main sequence. All of those have parameters that will affect the luminosity functions, but I'm not constraining those relations individually. So this is a global model fit. I'm fitting all of the parameters just on these three data sets, which are relatively direct observables. And do I get anything sensible? Well, fortunately, for purposes of this talk, I do. So I'm fitting the radio galaxy luminosity function very well. Again, sorry, I'm rushing. And I'm also fitting the optical luminosity functions quite well. These black bars denote the ones I actually fitted to. Again, come and chat to me later if you want the actual details. You should ignore a few points down here which are off due to completeness considerations. I'm not fitting to those anyway. But you see, if I fit these two bands, my model is actually predicting other bands reasonably well. You could argue that, you know, there's a few things a little bit off at the bright end, but actually this I band seems to have done remarkably well, not for any particular reason. There are a few other ingredients in here, but I'm not fitting to them, I'm predicting them, and it's doing a reasonably good job. Okay, so I can show you somewhere where it doesn't do a good job. So the blue here is the star-forming population of galaxies. Again, completely predicted based on those model fits. It's kind of close, but it's off by a little bit. And for passive galaxies, which is the red curves here, it's off by a lot. So there's clearly something up with this passive population of galaxies. But again, these are complete predictions, not based on even trying to fit any remotely similar data to this plot. And you know, the fact that it's in the ballpark for the star-forming galaxies is pretty encouraging. So applications of this I've talked about. You know, you can do Monte Carlo fits and include those in your large-scale structure analyses. These are analytics, so you can go away and play with them if you want. Like really, honest-to-goodness, pen-and-paper analytic. You can write them down. You can even analytically marginalize over some of these distributions, which is what I was trying to do in the beginning before I went down this whole rabbit hole of building a galaxy model. So it's not perfect, as we've seen, but you know, you can get somewhere with an analytic model that's more sophisticated than a standard halo model. And you know, obviously, once you have good model fits, you can generate a set of mock galaxy populations very quickly, and that's very useful for things like, measuring covariance matrices in large-scale structure surveys or things like that. So there's a ton of potential applications. You can use it anywhere that you'd use a halo model. And you can use it in some places where you'd use a semi-analytic model as well. Here's another application. I'm just going to skip past that because I'm way past time. And I'll leave you with the conclusions. So what I tried to argue at the beginning was that there are some subtle signatures of fundamental physics that we can't get to because of cosmic variance and other issues, except there are these kind of ways around the cosmic variance issue if you're willing to go out there and try and do a good job of modeling the connection between galaxies or other tracers and the underlying dark matter distribution. And so this model, it's actually called GHOST. It's all open source, publicly available. The paper is out. You can download the code and hack it to pieces however you like. This model is a step on the road to actually getting a good enough model to do this multi-tracer stuff in a tractable way so that we can actually go and maybe beat cosmic variance and learn something about Hubble scale physics, for example. Okay, and I'll stop there. Thanks for your patience.
So let me come back to my question. So we have this basically empirical model that is intrinsically stochastic because it's based on empirical data that you fit to some relation to some scatter.
Yep.
So I go out and I measure the bias parameter for two different galaxy populations with infinite precision. And what did I really learn? In what sense is that beating cosmic variance when, basically it's just going back into this machinery and telling you that you need to tune these parameters in different ways? But, I mean, they're not physical parameters in some Lagrangian that take specific values. They're like fitting coefficients to these empirical relations. So, I mean, to connect it to your original point, like, what am I learning?
So, one thing you're learning, just sticking to the later end of this discussion for now, one thing you're learning is just the general properties of the populations of galaxies. And I disagree with you that these parameters aren't physical. They're not directly physical. But they're telling us something about physics. So in the same way that the tau, the optical depth parameter in cosmology, isn't directly telling us about some microphysics, it's telling us something very interesting about a whole bunch of physical processes that happen during reionization and a bit earlier on, for example. So I think we can all agree that having access to coarse grain parameters can have a lot of physical content as long as you're able to then link the values of those parameters to the microphysics. And so what I'm kind of saying with this kind of model is, in one of these hydrodynamical simulations, for example, where the real physics is, you can simulate this distribution. And you can imagine having a few different hydrodynamical models that predict this distribution, and it'll hopefully have a similar form to the one I've been showing you. And so you can then go out and measure that using this machinery, and then decide which of those hydrodynamical simulations is actually the correct view of the universe, the one that got the feedback model correct or something. So this is an intermediate model. It's not a physical model, but it's not a purely empirical model either. It's a way of kind of connecting those two approaches. How that relates to the cosmic variance problem, this multi-tracer thing I showed, these B parameters aren't per galaxy parameters. These are just the mean bias for a whole population of galaxies. So in fact, the thing that matters for this is really just knowing this coarse grain property of the whole distribution. The all the galaxies that you classify as tracer one, for example. And so you could worry that, that there's an effective error bar on that. If that effective error bar is too large, you don't beat cosmic variance. But if it's smaller, you do. And the indications are that it should actually be smaller. So, and you can measure this better than you would just with two separate tracers in the cosmic variance regime. So that was a very long and complicated answer. We can chat about it later if you like.
So can you, from your model, now, I don't think you've shown that, can you predict the bias parameter for different populations, and how does it, can you check it, compare it to simulations or anything, any sense in which that works?
So, that's a good spot, because I haven't mentioned the actual, you know, this actual parameter that I was originally trying to predict anywhere in this talk, and it's because I haven't done it yet. So I can predict the bias on large scales, but I don't have a satisfactory model of what we'd normally call the one halo term, which I guess comes back to your point of, you know, modeling individual profiles within galaxies and things like that. So because there's not an explicit one halo term in this anywhere, I can't do the small scale galaxy clustering, but I can do the large scale two halo term galaxy clustering. I just haven't.
So what would be the analytic form of the two halo term?
Within this halo model approach, it's pretty much just, so you know what the halo bias should be. So for a given dark matter halo, you have the bias as a function of halo mass. So given, so when I say a tracer, I actually mean a set of galaxies that, you know, carves out some chunk of this full joint distribution. What I would do is average that halo bias over that chunk of the joint distribution. Okay, so saying I have a tracer, just plops down a selection function within this model space, I then integrate over that and get the mean bias for that tracer using this halo bias. And that's the normal way that people do it in the halo model. So you do exactly the same thing here, except, you know, there's just a more sophisticated model of the galaxies going on.
So underneath. Basically, like in the equation for the true halo term, you change the profile, like the halo occupation distribution. So you change both the profiles of how galaxies are both on halos and the number density.
So those profiles enter into the one halo term. Like so within a halo, I mean, we can discuss this after, perhaps. So, you know.
Yeah, but
I can write the equation down for you, and
One technical point. Ignore the correlations. Does that mean your 17 independent variable joint distribution is really the product of 17 individual ones?
So when I say I ignore the correlations, I mean ignore some correlations. Okay, so all of these I showed you just now. So where is it? There it is. This is general. You can do this in general. Any joint distribution you can decompose into a chain of conditionals in this way. When I say I ignore some correlations, I mean on occasion, and this only happens in a couple of places in the model, actually, due to not having access to a sensible functional form for what that should look like. But I mean, instead of doing P of A given B and C, maybe B alone strongly predicts A enough that I can ignore the dependence on C. So I would change that to an approximate equals sign, and then just write P of A given B in this.
So
these few cases.
How many different functions are you putting together to make the one growing one?
Let's count them. I'm assuming the halo mass. This is 1, 2, 3, 4.
But you said you have 17 variables.
I have 17 free parameters.
So I'm expecting you to have a 17-dimensional conditional probability distribution.
The joint distribution is 17 parameters, but it's decomposed into these. I think I see what you're saying. Are you saying that things much later on?
I don't really know what the decomposition is. It's not complicated.
Yeah, I can maybe show you. And,
that's what this figure is. Like each circle in the figure is one function that will play together to make this up. It might be parameterized by multiple parameters. So both these is a Gaussian thing, it's got an invariant. Each of these circles could incorporate
multiple variables. Is that going to be my parameters as opposed to infrared luminosity being a parameter. The infrared luminosity is a prediction, not a parameter.
That's all. Well, yeah, so that's yeah, that's a good point. So the model has I wonder if I wrote down one of the functions. I didn't. We can discuss this afterwards, and I'll show you what I mean. That there are two senses of this word parameter. You're quite right. So these are the, you know, parameters I'm trying to model, and then the overall statistical model also has some parameters which govern the shapes of these distributions. So yeah, okay. Sorry for the confusion.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Right. Is there no more questions?
Thank you.